From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the number killed in Gaza continues to grow as Israel's Prime Minister insists international pressure won't stop his country acting against Hamas militants.
There's a lot of criticism about Israel's airstrikes. There's a feeling that most of the top Hamas leaders are in hiding and none of the airstrikes are going to hit them, so most of the damage is coming down on the shoulders of average civilians.
Also today, we hear from the influential, best-selling French author and economist Thomas Piketty. And Amnesty International say pro-Russian separatists have carried out hundreds of abductions and inflicted savage beatings and torture against Ukrainians.
They applied electric shocks to him. They then stubbed out cigarettes on his leg and he showed us the scar. There's practically a hole in his knee.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will resist international pressure to halt the country's military assault on the Gaza Strip. He was speaking after Palestinian officials claimed the death toll from Israeli airstrikes has now risen above 100. The health ministry says 675 people have been wounded since the violence began. The White House is offering to mediate a cessation of hostilities, and Middle East envoy Tony Blair says the international community must formulate a response to the crisis.
We're at a very, very critical point, and obviously in the international community and in the region, I think we have got to do everything we can to put in place both that short-term change in the circumstances here and then that longer-term plan that allows us to create a situation in which the people in Gaza, the West Bank and in Israel feel that this is not then going to recur.
US Secretary of State John Kerry has met the leading candidates for the Afghan president in a visit to Kabul. Ashraf Ghani, one of the candidates disputing the outcome of the elections, called for what he called an extensive audit of votes. The former foreign minister Abdullah Abdullah has also alleged irregularities in the electoral process and has been threatening to set up a parallel government to protest against the country's political stalemate. The Secretary of State told reporters he's optimistic the standoff over the elections can be resolved.
I'm here because President Obama and the United States of America are deeply interested in a unified, democratic, and stable Afghanistan. We obviously have high hopes that the questions about the election will be resolved quickly.
A child born in the American state of Mississippi who was believed to have been cured of HIV/AIDS is showing signs of renewed infection. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Daniel Wrenches reports.
In March 2013, doctors announced that 30 hours after a baby was born in Mississippi, the newborn was treated with a range of antiretroviral drugs and that this treatment had cured the child. It raised hopes that this could set a precedent worldwide. But 2 years later, doctors have discovered after testing that the virus is present in the child's blood. The researchers say the fact that it didn't reoccur for 2 years is still unprecedented, but plans for a major trial of the treatment may now have to be scaled back or adapted. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin is in Cuba at the beginning of a tour of Latin America. Moscow cancelled 90% of Cuba's debt to Russia before his arrival. He'll be at the World Cup final in Brazil on Sunday and then at a summit of emerging economies in the Brazilian city of Fortaleza. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The German foreign minister says he will bring up the spy row with Washington when he crosses paths with US Secretary of State John Kerry in Vienna next week. From FSN's bureau in Berlin, Ira Spitzer reports.
German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier called the expulsion of the unnamed American intelligence officer necessary and appropriate, but also said he doesn't want a damaging dispute with the US. Both Steinmeier and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry are planning to attend talks in Vienna about Iran's nuclear program in the coming days. Steinmeier says he will raise the spying issue on the sidelines. Senior U.S. officials have yet to comment directly on the situation, which involves two separate incidents of apparent American intelligence operatives in Germany. The U.S. government has, however, released several statements recently reiterating the importance of the German-American relationship. Ira Spitzer, Berlin.
Police in Brazil say the head of a ticket partner to soccer's world governing body FIFA has fled his hotel to avoid arrest over an alleged multi-million dollar touting operation. Ray Whelan, who is from the UK and runs Match Hospitality, left his Rio hotel just an hour before police arrived. From FSN's London Bureau, Jake Rashbass reports.
Ray Whelan was first arrested earlier this week at the exclusive Copacabana Palace Hotel and released on bail after questioning. Police say he is now being officially considered a fugitive after they discovered he'd left the hotel. Detectives are investigating a gang which is reported to have made around $90 million per tournament at up to four World Cups. His employer Match insists that Whelan has done nothing wrong and claims the Brazilian authorities simply do not understand how their business works. FIFA has said it will fully collaborate with the local authorities and will provide any details requested. Jake Rashbass, London.
And that is the latest feature story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said international pressure will not stop his country acting against militants. The death toll from Israeli airstrikes on Gaza now stands at over 100, with hundreds more injured, according to Palestinian sources. President Obama is offering the United States help with ceasefire negotiations. Israel has carried out hundreds of airstrikes since launching its operation against Hamas on Tuesday. No Israelis have been killed by ongoing Hamas rocket attacks, with the country's Iron Dome defense system countering the threats. Krista Case Bryant is Israel Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor.
According to a human rights organization in Gaza called Al-Mizan, it's actually up to 103 dead and more than 600 injured. And according to their investigations, and of course, I'm sure Israeli human rights organizations would have a different standard and the Israeli government has an even different standard, but according to Al-Mizan, 69 of the 103 killed were civilians. And so there's a lot of criticism about Israel's airstrikes. There's a feeling that most of the top Hamas leaders are in hiding and none of the airstrikes are going to hit them. So most of the damage is coming down on the shoulders of average civilians. And on the Israeli side, we saw a rocket hit Haifa, or the siren went off in Haifa, which I think is the first time that's ever happened for a rocket from Gaza. And so the rocket fire is really covering quite a large part of the country. The latest figure I saw was 5 million of Israel's 8 million citizens are at risk from the rocket attacks. Of course, none of them have been killed, but there were the first serious injuries today.
So Hamas rocket capabilities, they've actually become more of a threat to Israel? Has this come as a surprise to the IDF?
Well, I can't say whether the IDF is surprised or not. I think everybody knew that during the tenure of Egypt's President Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood, there was a lot freer access to get weapons into the Gaza Strip. And one former Israeli official who served as Netanyahu's national security advisor during that time told me that it was practically like a highway in terms of what Hamas was able to bring into the Gaza Strip. So despite the fact that they've really been struggling the last 6 to 9 months under Egypt's crackdown since Morsi was ousted, they were able to really rebuild their arsenal. And from what I understand, they have maybe slightly more in terms of numbers of rockets, but the mid-range rockets are significantly more precise now. And they also seem to have acquired long-range rockets that they didn't have in the previous conflict in November 2012. So that's why we're seeing the strikes that go even beyond Tel Aviv. I mean, I think in 2012, it was a really big deal that the sirens were going off in Tel Aviv, and now they're reaching almost twice as far. So that's a really significant escalation. And the sirens have gone off multiple times in Jerusalem as well, and then Haifa, as I mentioned earlier.
But it seems that that Iron Dome defense system is doing its job so far.
Yes, Iron Dome, I think, has intercepted more than 80 of the rockets fired and seems to be fairly savvy about not wasting its fire on ones that are going to fall in open areas. And reportedly, it's registering a 90% success rate this time versus 80% in the last conflict.
And what have you heard in terms of, so far it's been obviously airstrikes being used by the Israeli military, but what about rumours of a ground offensive?
You know, I think that's something that the Security Cabinet is deliberating very closely. It is a big decision to go in and do something like that, and it could get Israel involved in a much bigger mess. Of course, it's a lot harder to limit Israeli casualties when you go into such a dense urban warfare situation. So the jury is still out on whether they'll do that. But I did hear from my colleague in Gaza that everything is shut down there. All the shops are closed. All the cars are parked. Nobody's moving because there's such a concern that there will be an invasion.
The United States, Krista, has offered to facilitate a ceasefire between those warring sides. But some criticism from both Israelis and Palestinians that perhaps the U.S. isn't doing enough.
I think on the Israeli side, at least in terms of where civilians are coming from, there's an overall feeling that the world as a whole just does not understand what it's like to face these sort of rocket barrages. And as one woman said to me, you know, what would the United States do if Mexico was throwing things over the border? You'd probably have major airstrikes, if not an invasion. And so there's just sort of this incomprehension of how come the world can't understand how much we're under attack. On the other hand, you have people looking at the casualties, I mean, the very disproportionate casualties on two sides. I mean, no Israelis killed and more than 100 Palestinians killed. And you have the Palestinians saying, why is everybody in the world so quiet about this in the face of such awful aggression that's killing women and children? What did these little children do to deserve this? And so there's a feeling that the U.S. has lost its role as a fair broker. And I mean, that has been accumulating for a long time. That was very prevalent comment around the time that the negotiations fell apart this spring. And this is just compounding that feeling.
Krista Case Bryant, Israel Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. This is FSN Reports. Russia, Ukraine and the European Union have come together in Brussels for the first round of trilateral talks on the implementation of the controversial trade pact between Ukraine and the EU. The talks will focus on how that free trade agreement will impact Russia's economy. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko signed the treaty at the end of June this year. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman has been following the consultations in Brussels.
Well, Russia has long claimed and very publicly criticized the free trade deal between the EU and Ukraine for possibly harming Russian exports. There's been criticism that with Ukraine trying to adapt its regulations to EU standards and signing this free trade deal, imports to Ukraine of Russian products could be hampered, and the Russian market would, of course, be affected. So Moscow was keen to reopen discussions about how this trade deal would affect businesses there. Now, what EU officials are saying is that so far, according to their studies, there's been little evidence that the Russian economy could be badly affected. And the perception here is that there's been an exaggerated response from Moscow, that Ukraine will continue to receive imports from Russia as before. And there's a sense also that any qualms from Russia about the deal itself will only be left to very minor, superficial, technical details about the implementation of the deal. Because let's remember, this is a done deal. It was an association agreement signed between the EU's 28 leaders and Ukraine's newly elected president, Petro Poroshenko. So according to the EU, Moscow now has very little say in what is essentially a bilateral trade agreement between the EU and Ukraine.
Sandra, how much room is there really for maneuver on this deal?
What Moscow is trying to do is seek specific issues that it foresees might be a problem. And EU officials say this is now an exercise simply in really peeling back the layers of an onion to see if there are any issues at the bottom. Now, they say that, of course, revisiting the deal is off the table. And in fact, these discussions hadn't taken place in the early stages back in November when this trade deal was being discussed with Ukraine's former president, Viktor Yanukovych, because Moscow essentially shouldn't have been part of those discussions. This was a bilateral agreement being discussed and negotiated between the EU and Ukraine. But now that the deal has been signed and Russia has come to the table with several criticisms and concerns. The EU says that, you know, it's willing to listen to those. And according to its own evidence, there seems to be no real problems. So I think at the moment, the discussions are about perhaps creating an advisory group, a trilateral consultation, things that can be ironed out before the free trade deal is ratified by the EU's separate governments.
Sandra Gatzman in Brussels. The EU trade pact was the same deal that former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych backed out of last year under pressure from Moscow, triggering the Ukrainian revolution. The fallout saw conflict between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian fighters flare in eastern Ukraine, with that death toll still rising. Kiev officials said Friday that a rocket attack by pro-separatists may have killed at least 30 soldiers and border guards. Meanwhile, Amnesty International say hundreds of cases of abductions, beatings and torture have taken place amid separatist violence in the country's east. Heather McGill is Amnesty's Ukraine expert.
This week we've been talking to former hostages who are now in Kiev. And two of my colleagues were in Kiev 2 weeks ago and they visited Mariupol, a town in eastern Ukraine, which had been very much a focus of the fighting but has now been regained by the Ukrainian forces. So we've been talking to a lot of people, we've heard their stories, and our call is really based on that testimony from ordinary people.
Among those targeted, not just the police and the military, also, though, as we heard, journalists, politicians are in there, activists, business people. Give us an idea of what, though, they're being subjected to. What have you heard?
Well, for instance, we talked to a young man called Sasha, who'd been detained in eastern Ukraine, and he had been known for his sympathies with Kiev, so he'd been very clearly defending the idea of one Ukraine. And so he was detained in Mariupol, and he told us that he was beaten very severely by armed groups, anti-Kiev armed groups. They applied electric shocks to him. They handcuffed him. They applied electric wires to the handcuffs. They then stubbed out cigarettes on his leg, and he showed us the scar. There's practically a hole in his knee where they stubbed out a cigarette, and then they continuously inserted burning cigarettes into the hole in his knee. We have stories of Hannah, who was detained with her boyfriend. Again, they were ordinary people just known for their Kiev, their pro-Kiev sympathies. She was threatened with a knife, and the knife was waved in front of her, and she was slashed with a knife. She and her boyfriend were then forced to clean out a truck which they believed had been used to carry dead bodies, and she was particularly appalled at that. So we have beatings, we have electric shock, burnings, slashings with knives.
Just appalling. And as a result, you're calling on the government there to investigate. How tough, though, will that be for them? Are you able to tell them who the perpetrators are?
Well, it's very difficult to know exactly how many of these cases there are. You gave a figure of 500. Well, that's a figure that the Ukrainian government has been giving. But, of course, they've got their reasons to want to inflate that figure and show how bad the anti-Kiev forces are. It's obviously, in some cases, not too difficult to know because we know the places, the people have even got names. And so in those cases, it's probably possible. Although, of course, among these armed groups, it's a very diverse group of... Some of them are criminals. Some of them have actually, we believe, we have testimony that they may have been removed from prison. Some of them are local citizens. Some of them have come from Russia. So, that, you know, there could be a great difficulty in actually being able to put these people on trial.
Amnesty International's Heather McGill talking to Lisa Aziz on Britain's LBC Radio. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. Here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, an interview with the French economist Thomas Piketty. His book, Capital in the 21st Century, has become a worldwide bestseller since its publication last year. Not since the works of Milton Friedman or John Maynard Keynes has an economist found his work so widely discussed. The book charts the distribution of global wealth over the past 250 years, and it finds in the developed world a growing disparity – between the sluggish rate of economic growth and the substantial rate of capital return for the economic elites. To reverse that disparity, Piketty controversially proposes a global tax on wealth that he says could help redistribute income and lead to a greater degree of fairness and equity. Thomas Piketty sat down with Ryan Avent, economics correspondent for The Economist.
Yeah, so there are really two processes going on. One is about the rise of the inequality of labor income, and another possible evolution for the future is the rise in inequality of property, inequality of wealth. So if we start with the rise of labor income inequality, particularly in the United States over the past few decades, you know, I think this has partly to do with the changing supply and demand of skills, with globalization and, you know, probably too unequal access to education and skills in the US. Now, that's probably not going to be enough to explain the rise of, you know, the top 1% of 0.1%, because it's not as if the education of this group is a lot higher than the next 1 or 2%. So here, you know, to explain this part of the story, which is only one part of the story, but it's an important one quantitatively, according to our findings with Emmanuel Saez. Probably you have to look deeper as to, you know, how top managerial compensation is being set. And you know, I think our textbook economics model, you know, is saying that when you are paid more, it must be that your marginal productivity, your marginal contribution to the output of your company is higher. And this is probably a good model for most of the distribution of wages. Now, is it a good model at the very top, you know, when you manage to get a pay increase from $1 million to $10 million or from 10 to 50? Does this necessarily mean that your marginal product has gone up that much? You know, I think it would be a very naive view of how the labor market operates.
So we have the story about labor income. Are we seeing a rise in the concentration of wealth in the hands of a relatively small share of the population?
In the United States, I think we do. In Europe, it's more limited, and the main phenomenon, the main evolution so far has been an increase in the total quantity of wealth relative to income. But in terms of concentration, you know, it's either stable or rising slightly. Now, the fact is that even though it has not, you know, even though we are not back to the extreme level of wealth inequality that we had prior to World War I, we are still at a level of inequality of wealth that's much higher than the inequality of labor earning.
Wealth and capital are becoming more important in the economy. And the book explains some of the dynamics that are generating this shift. So why is wealth becoming more important, both relative to income and in terms of the overall distribution of resources?
So it's really the combination of several forces. The first explanation for the return of, you know, what I call a, you know, patrimonial society or high wealth to income ratio is largely a long run recovery process. You know, in the 50s, 60s, the total quantity of household net wealth relative to GDP was only, you know, 2 to 3 years of GDP, as opposed to, you know, 6 to 7 years of GDP on the eve of World War I. And this is largely because, you know, wealth destruction during World War I, World War II, very limited investment, you know, a big part of private saving, for instance, in Britain, was absorbed by public debt to pay for the war, and then this was destroyed by inflation in the post-war period. Also, you know, you had some policies like, you know, nationalization, rent controls that reduced the market value of real estate property in the 50s and 60s. And then you have a long recovery. And so part of what we're seeing of this long-run recovery of the wealth-to-income ratio just comes from this sort of natural process. And let me be very clear that there is nothing bad per se about that. You know, we should not be nostalgic of the 50s and 60s where, you know, all the wealth had been destroyed and very little had been invested for so long. The other part of the story is also the decline of population growth. You know, we had in this baby boom cohort period, you know, population growth was adding a lot to productivity growth in order to produce high GDP growth rate. And, you know, we should not forget that, you know, half of historical growth in GDP comes from population. Now, this seems to be over, at least in European countries, in Japan. And this is part of the reason why we see in those countries more than in the United States a rise in the wealth to income ratio.
How important is different savings behavior among different sort of demographic groups to this story. So as I think about the dynamic of an aging population and contributing to slowing growth rates, it also suggests to me that we're going to have people who are running down their savings as they retire, and so that if they're running down their savings, wealth and capital wouldn't be as likely to accumulate. Is that right, or should we expect something different?
Well, it's you know, again, nobody knows what future saving behavior will be like. Empirical evidence suggests that there are, you know, many different reasons why people save, and there doesn't seem to be any obvious reason why the saving rate, as we get richer and richer, will actually go down. You know, they could remain the same, they could be higher, they could be smaller. But, you know, we should not believe that simply because of aging, at some point people will just draw on their assets. You know,
right.
This can be counteracted by many other forces.
One of the main policy recommendations in the book is a global tax on wealth. That may be attractive for some reasons, but it's, politically it seems like it might be a difficult step to take for a lot of countries. Are there other things that could work at a national level that governments ought to focus on if they're concerned about income concentration, wealth concentration?
You know, right now the average income of Harvard parents of Harvard students is equivalent to the average income of the top 2% of the U.S. distribution of income, which is, you know, I think a bit too much, you know, because you want to have a meritocratic system with broader access to top schools. You know, no country has invented the right system yet. Now, education is important, but sometimes, yeah, we also need progressive taxation of income, and also progressive taxation of wealth. You know, look, in Britain, you have a debate right now about mansion tax, and in fact, you know, as far as I know, there is a 5% tax rate on transaction above £1 million that was created by a Labour government, and then the Conservative government created a 7% tax rate on mansions above £2 million. So there seems to be a debate that goes beyond left and right. Now, of course, you can do more, especially for large financial portfolios, if you have more international cooperation. And you know, this is true for the taxations of multinational corporate profits. You know, right now, our small and medium-sized businesses are paying higher effective tax rates than large multinational corporations, you know, which is not good in terms of equity, but that's not good in terms of growth either. You know, I think 5 years ago, everybody would have said that bank secrecy in Switzerland will be with us forever. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the US government came with sanctions on Swiss banks, and Switzerland and then Luxembourg and other European countries have agreed to enter into automatic exchange of information. So if you put the right sanctions and you analyze the cost and benefits of financial opacity for the different countries and put sanctions that are in line with the benefits that some people or some countries are getting out of opacity, then you can make progress. So, you know, I am much more optimistic than what a number of people seem to believe after they've read my book. And so I feel that sad, you know, if my book has made people pessimistic. And, you know, I think there are reasons to be reasonably optimistic.
That's Thomas Piketty talking about his best-selling book, Capital in the 21st Century, with Ryan Avent, the economics correspondent for The Economist. You can see more of the newspaper's coverage of Mr. Piketty's book in the paper itself and online at economist.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Monday, the latest from the Middle East unrest as the surge of violence between Israel and Hamas continues. That's Monday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Simon Marks with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere. Have a great weekend. Goodbye.